That is, again, there was an argument that suggested that you had a huge monolithic society which was labeled Hindu, and you had an equally large monolithic society that was labeled Muslim, and these two societies were constantly in confrontation. The nature of this relationship was totally dismissed by once again imposing the communal ideologies onto the earlier period. Let me give you an example of the way in which this was done, and I think this is an example which will probably trigger off as much heat as the Aryan question did yesterday. The example is the treatment of the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb. Now, we've all been brought up to believe that Aurangzeb was physically ugly, he was totally rabid, he was a complete fanatic Muslim who did his best to destroy everything that was at all sacred to the Hindus. An altogether disgusting character, shall we say. And it is true, Aurangzeb destroyed temples. Aurangzeb was anti-Hindu up to a point. And so the typical image that was presented was that all Muslim rulers had a touch of Aurangzeb in them, more or less. And consequently, Hindu culture was at a very poor ebb, at a very low ebb. There was foreign rule. This in spite of the fact that what we today recognize as Hinduism was precisely the religion that developed during this period and developed with great strength and developed with great articulation. So where the question of oppressing Hinduism comes in is anyway a doubtful question. When I say this, I mean oppression on a large scale. When you look at Aurangzeb and the data on his reign, what is very interesting, and there have been two or three volumes published on this, is the number of grants that he gave to Brahmins, to temples, to various Hindu religious sects. Grant after grant, grant of land, grant of money, gifts, presents. And this is contained in a multi-volume work called The Farmans of Aurangzeb, in which these grants are actually listed. And then you ask yourself the question, what is this contradiction that on the one hand he's making these grants to the temples, he's helping them grow and develop, he's making endless grants to Brahmins, on the other hand he is actually destroying temples. For example, he goes off to Vrindavan, to Mathura, and he destroys a temple which is supposed to have been built on the place where Krishna was born. Now, the communalist historian will simply dismiss this as saying he was a bigoted anti-Hindu, he was a fanatic Muslim, and therefore he destroyed temples, and will totally dismiss the other side of the evidence. What we do today is to say, right, there is a contradiction in this situation. We must look at each example of temple destruction and try and find out why he indulged in temple destruction. And we must look at each example where he makes a huge grant to a temple and find out why he does so. And frequently the answer is that, for example, the temple that he destroyed in Mathura was built by a person called Bir Singh Gundela, who was one of the arch rebels against Aurangzeb, was a supporter of his brother, who was also a claimant to the throne, was therefore a natural enemy of the man who finally was successful and came to power. And when Bir Singh Deo Bodela built this temple and said that this temple stands as my symbol of rebellion against Aurangzeb, it is not to be surprised. One is not surprised then that Aurangzeb comes along and says, right, I'll show you what I do to your symbol. I will destroy your symbol. Similarly, when he makes a large grant to another temple, he's doing it to a temple built by somebody who is a supporter of Mughal power, and therefore he wants to give more strength to the supporters of Mughal power. What I'm trying to suggest is that this whole relationship between what we call the Hindus and the Muslims is not a simple one-to-one relationship. It is in fact an extremely complicated relationship. And by dismissing it as a one-to-one relationship, we are not doing justice, not only not to our history, but we're not doing justice to our whole cultural tradition. We have to try and understand the sensitivities involved in this kind of relationship and try and understand what is it in the nature of Indian society that led to these sensitivities and to these kinds of relationships. Now, that is one aspect of what is happening in the 20th century. Another aspect is the growth, the emergence and growth of regional history, something that one hears of at great length these days, because it is still growing enormously. But it does raise a number of questions, and these are questions that I would like to leave you with, because I think they're questions that we should be asking ourselves. First of all, what is the definition of a region? There is a tendency today to take the existing state boundaries of India, boundaries that grew out of the linguistic agitation, and argue that these were historically viable regions going way back into the past. And so you have a history of Punjab, a history of Gujarat, a history of Uttar Pradesh, a history of Madhya Pradesh, a history of the Northeast, a history of Karnataka, and so on. Are these, in fact, viable regions? This is, as a historian, a question that I would like you to consider. Is it perhaps not better that we go back to geography and look at what geographers call nuclear regions, based on geographical factors, which are in fact factors of much more long-standing existence than historical factors, and try and see what the configuration of regions would be if we looked at geographically nuclear regions? We would then find, for example, that to talk about the viability of some states, such as Madhya Pradesh, forgive me those of you that are from Madhya Pradesh, but really Madhya Pradesh as a region, as a single region, has never existed until it was created recently. It's always been part of other regions. And historically, therefore, it makes much more sense to see it in those terms rather than to try and push for the existence of a state, a present-day state, having had a historical entity. Similarly, in the Northeast, all these multiple little states that we have created, none of them really had a historical viability going back into early periods. They are, in fact, creations of political situations emerging out of the last two centuries. And this question of the viability of a region is an extremely significant question which we have to consider, because it does have very important implications for the history of India. The identity of a region is also sometimes equated with the identity of the dominant social group in that region. I have immense problems, for example, sitting on boards of studies in various universities when history syllabi come up, and one is told, for example, that a course which is labeled the history of Punjab begins with the birth of Guru Nanak. And as a good Punjabi, I will sit there and argue that there was a lot to the history of Punjab before the birth of Guru Nanak. And therefore, if you are going to teach a course on the history of the Punjab, you must take it right back to the beginnings of when we have information. Or similarly, you may have a course on the history of Maharashtra, which starts with Maratha ascendancy, which would be equally non-viable. Again, there is this danger that it is the dominant group that pushes for the identity of regional history, and this then leads to the next problem, which is that, of course, of regional chauvinism. Regional history begins to become much more important, much more significant than national history. Those of us that belong to a generation when we were still young at the time of the national movement, maybe we have an old-fashioned view of this, but certainly I feel very strongly about the fact that one cannot indulge in glorifying the history of a region and pulling it out, as it were, and treating it as something distinct from the history of the rest of the country. And I would go even further and say the history of the whole subcontinent of India, which is the context in which these regional histories have to be considered. I'm not saying this just in order to sound hysterical. This is a problem that is being very seriously faced by school boards of textbooks and syllabi, where it is frequently argued that it's not necessary to teach children the history of India. It's quite enough if they know the history of their state. Why do you wish to overburden them? And this is a fundamental question that faces not only historians, but faces all of us who are considering the future of the relationship between history and the kind of society that we are building. Regional history, therefore, cannot be an end in itself. It has to be seen always in the context of the broader national history. But there are certain very positive features of regional history which need to be emphasized. First of all, the interest in regional history has led to the discovery of a multiplicity of new evidence, whether it is archaeology, whether it is inscriptions, whether it is art remains, whether it is texts and manuscripts, the kinds of things I was mentioning yesterday, such as Vamshavalis and Mahatmyas, chronicles and so on, or whether it is even 19th century ethnography dealing with a region and providing evidence of the major history of that region. So that a lot of this kind of local archival history too, which tended to be ignored by earlier historians who were looking at the totality of Indian history, this is extremely important and is surfacing. Secondly, regional history also corrects the perspective of what I was talking about yesterday, the obsession with seeing Indian history from the background of the Ganges Valley. The kind of obsession that existed amongst imperialist historians continued with a lot of nationalist historians as well. We now recognize not only the necessity to look at different regions and look at their history and integrate that with the history of the subcontinent, but we also recognize what is called a shift in nuclear regions, using the nuclear region in historical terms to mean core areas where developments take place, such as the core areas of kingdoms or the core areas where important historical changes occur. And the questions that we have to ask then are questions like, for example, why is there a shift of urbanization from the Indus Valley to the Ganges Valley between the second millennium and the first millennium BC? Or why is it that, for example, in the peninsula, you have the Raichur Doab, which plays an extremely important role at a certain point in history? Or you have the Kaveri Valley, which plays an extremely important role as a core region. And the notion then of core regions and peripheries and the shifting focus of these core regions or nuclear regions becomes extremely important and brings in the whole geographical dimension into the study of history as well, and leads to a different set of questions. One is now no longer generalizing from what is happening in one part of the subcontinent. One is looking at what is happening everywhere and trying to see, is the same thing happening, or are there changes, are there variations? Do some things happen earlier, other things happen later? If so, why? What are the reasons for this? The complexity then of even the national history is enriched by the fact that there is this kind of evidence coming from the regions. The third important feature of regional history is that it challenges the concept of the Golden Age and the Dark Age, the kind of thing that Vincent Smith was developing. According to Vincent Smith, the period from the 8th to the 13th century was a very major Dark Age, because the Gupta Empire collapsed and there were a series of small kingdoms. We didn't know very much about them. In fact, today, we see this period as a very major period of change and development in Indian history, where you have new art styles, new architectural styles based on local styles. You have the roots of the regional languages going back to this period. Very often you have the beginnings of religious sects that had a regional base, such as the various sects of what is broadly called the Bhakti movement, again going back to this period. In fact, one might say that in many ways one of the major identities of modern Indian culture goes back precisely to this period, and it is no longer regarded as a dark age. It's regarded very much as an age which throws considerable light both on itself and on the subsequent period. And finally, of course, the study of regional history again challenges the older periodization, because, as I said earlier, the threefold periodization of Hindu, Muslim, and British cannot be applied to every region of the subcontinent. Now, in many of these situations, I've been talking about historians with an ideological position looking at data and interpreting it very much along the lines which were developed in the 19th and the early 20th century. I would now like to turn to a very different kind of historical writing, which is what we sometimes term a change of paradigm. It looks at history from a very different point of view, and I'm referring here to the Marxist interpretation of Indian history. I would say that the Marxist interpretation in many ways is much more important in the long run as a catalyst than even as an explanation. The change of paradigm is precisely that historians are now no longer concerned with merely the narrative of political dynasties or with chronology. They are concerned with how society actually functions. And this is by no means something that was started by Marxist historians. It is a concern that even the nationalist historians had. But the way in which it was intensively analyzed by Marxist historians was really the way in which it worked as a catalyst. The stress or importance in this kind of interpretation is on what is called the mode of production. This is frequently confused with economic determinism, and I would urge that we do keep the two things quite separate, because in fact it is not the same as economic determinism. It does give a lot of emphasis to economics, but at the same time a mode of production has to consider other features as being equally important, such as the environment, the availability of labor and the process of organizing labor, technology, social organization, and ideology. And the way in which Marxist interpretations of history have developed all over the world, these other factors are beginning to play an increasingly important role as compared to the early essays into Marxist historiography, in which there was a tendency to emphasize only the economic factor. Marx himself, as I mentioned yesterday, provided one model for European history where he argued that there was an evolution in European society. We're going back again a little bit to social Darwinism that I was talking about yesterday. There was an evolution to European society which moved from a condition of primitive communism, where everything was equal, everything was shared, what is today sometimes called a band society, B-A-N-D. It moved from a situation of equality into a situation of inequality. Remember what I mentioned yesterday about the thesis and the antithesis. A society produces its contradiction. It produces characteristics which upset the existing system. And out of this confrontation, a new society emerges. The new society that emerges out of primitive communism is the slave mode of production. And Marx argued that Greece and Rome, the societies of the Mediterranean, were characterized by a slave mode of production where the labor power was provided by the slaves and the owners of slaves were the owners of the means of production. This, in turn, in the first millennium AD, gave way to what is called the feudal mode of production, where the labor power is provided by the serfs and ownership is in the hands of lords and vassals. And this in turn broke down at the end of the 18th century and or sometime varying in different parts of Europe and gave way to the emergence of capitalism, where again the labor power is provided by the proletariat, ownership is in the hands of industrialists. And capitalism will ultimately provide its own contradictions, which will lead to the breaking down of capitalism and the emergence of socialism and ultimately to a communist state. This was the five-phase periodization, as it were, the five-phase evolution that he suggested for European society. And as I mentioned, for Asia, he had this totally separate mode of production, the Asiatic mode of production, in which there was no change, and the whole question of the dialectics of thesis, antithesis, synthesis was totally eliminated. And this then was a problem that was facing Indian Marxist historians. Do we or do we not accept the Asiatic mode of production? Most Marxist historians have not accepted it because they have argued that the empirical data in India does not support this static model where there is no change and where there are no confrontations and no dialectic. It is, interestingly, of course, still supported by some theoreticians abroad in Europe and America, particularly in Europe, who would like to suggest that there was a lack of change in Asian societies. It is also, interestingly, being used politically in the Soviet Union as the confrontation between the White Russians and the Central Asian Soviet republics has begun to emerge. There has been a noticeable growth among Russian historians who argue that the Central Asian Soviet republics, after all, are based on the Asiatic mode of production, whereas the White Russian society went through this five-phase periodization. So what you're really getting, interestingly, is within Marxism a kind of status consciousness about which periodization is the more superior. The basic debate among Indian Marxists is, does the Indian data support the five-phase periodization? Does one talk about a slave mode of production and a feudal mode of production and the transition to capitalism? Or alternatively, is it possible to use the Marxist method but arrive at a totally different kind of periodization which is much more specific to the Indian data? And there are a number of Marxist historians who are arguing, like D.D. Kosambi argued, that it is not necessary to conform to the Marxist periodization, that it is possible to look at the Indian data and try and analyze it and see what the Indian data suggests. The main importance is, of course, that by introducing this change of theory, of paradigm into Indian history, the discussions initiated by Marxist historians have opened up a whole new range of questions in relation to history, in relation to the past, in relation to the way in which historians examine the past, the methodologies that are adopted by historians. And to that extent, I think that the injection, as it were, of Marxism into the study of Indian history has played an extremely positive role in opening up the whole discussion to a new set of questions. These are questions that deal with things like the importance of economic and social history, which is something that was never emphasized to that degree in the past, the move away from history being considered to be just dynastic history to history being concerned with economy and society, to a completely new understanding of caste. And I gather that Professor Betai did talk to you on this question. A new understanding of caste in terms of a particular interest in what was happening to the lower castes right through Indian history. A question which historians didn't ask earlier. The concern was always, whenever one talked about society up to and during the period before the 1950s, it was always on the basis of what happened to Brahmins and Kshatriyas. The occasional Vaishya may have slipped in. But now there is this interest also in what happened to the bulk of society, which was that of Shudras, untouchables, tribals, and what have you. How did they relate to historical events and historical happenings? It has also initiated a tremendous interest in technological history. If one is going to talk about agriculture and the economy, one must talk about irrigation. One must then talk about methods of irrigation. One must talk about the Persian wheel, one must talk about tank irrigation, one must talk about canals, anicuts, and the whole system of irrigation on which agriculture was based, from which revenue was collected, which revenue was the basis of the power of the dynasty. So that this kind of logical causation becomes much more important. And finally also the interest of relating society to ideology. Whether it is religious ideology, religious ritual and practice, whether it is philosophy, the interrelationship between the two becomes extremely important, and religion is no longer studied in isolation. Religion is not something that exists up there. After all, religion is created by a society, it is created by the men and women who form that society, and it has a very close correlation with what is happening to the people involved. Let me turn now briefly to the post-Marxist situation, which is one in which there has been a tremendous impact of various methods and disciplines of the social sciences on the study of history. Again, it's not a change of paradigm in terms of providing a ready-made structure of explanation, but it is leading to all kinds of new questions, and it certainly is providing a whole range of new answers to a number of questions. This interest in the social sciences was partly triggered off by developments in European historiography, such as the famous French school of historians, who called themselves the school of annales, meaning annals, because they edited a journal which was called Annals or Annales, in which the emphasis was on social and economic history. The historian must find out what are the resources of a society, what is the mechanism by which a society controls these resources, what is the social ranking which these resources may lead to, and what is the linkage between ideology and various other factors. It is also the school of history which, together with other historians in other parts of Europe, argued that if you are going to study agricultural history, agrarian history, if you're going to study revenue systems in agrarian history, don't remain within the confines of the library or the government archives. Go out into the field. Go and see what is the kind of soil that is being cultivated. What are the crops that are being cultivated? What are the peculiarities of these crops? What is the kind of peasant organization that leads to this kind of cultivation? Who are the owners then of the soil, of the crops? Who are the controllers of the peasants, and so on? In other words, the whole notion of fieldwork comes to be introduced into the idea of going back into the past. A notion which previously was restricted to archaeology is now being used by modern historians as well. Another development occurs in which there is the study of people's attitudes and concepts, what is referred to by French historians as mentalité. What are the concepts that move people? If you're going to throw out a slogan like Quit India in the Indian context, how is it received by different categories of people? How is it translated into the languages? Are there nuances and overtones and undertones which may have had a special appeal to either the middle class or the peasantry, or a special appeal to the Hindi-speaking people as against the Tamil-speaking people, and so on? There's been some quite interesting work done on agrarian situations where there were peasant rebellions or peasant protest movements, for example, in Uttar Pradesh, where the Tulsi Ramcharitmanas is used as a text. There was a famous character called Baba Ramchandra who went around proclaiming a new age and used the whole idea of the Kali Yuga and the end of the Kali Yuga that occurs in the Tulsi Ramcharitmanas, and uses the notion of Ram Rajya. So historians are now concerned with trying to analyze what did this really mean? How did the peasant, in fact, relate his discontent into the more broader discontent of the national movement? The history of institutions are also looked at. One doesn't simply talk about institutions having existed in a certain period. One tries to see how institutions actually related to society at that time. Why were they created? What was the form that they took? What function did they perform? Did they integrate society? Did they alienate groups? And so on. And finally, of course, the whole very important question of environment and topography. Geology. This is a question that was particularly raised by a remarkable historian called Braudel, who referred to it as really the deepest, the longest kind of durability from the past. The one thing that has endured from the past into the present is, in fact, our landscape, our environment. And the historian cannot begin to study any aspect of the past unless he goes back to looking at the landscape and the environment and looking at what it was, how it was changed, was it changed, to what degree was it changed, how did it influence society, and so on. All of this, then, is something which has led to a tremendous new interest in aspects of history. We have related disciplines such as archaeology, which is now the major new source of information for the ancient period. Well, not only for the ancient period, in fact also for the medieval period. There is a very respectable branch of archaeology called medieval archaeology, and very soon in countries like ours we're also going to get industrial archaeology, which is the early beginnings of the switch from manufacturing techniques to factory techniques, the change from handicrafts to factory production, and so on. It is the major new source because it is the only source that gives us tangible evidence. The difference between a historical fact which sits in the mind of the historian or lies in a sentence of a book and an archaeological fact is that you can actually touch the archaeological fact. You can touch the potsherd, you can touch the metal utensil, it's a three-dimensional fact. And that makes a lot of difference to our understanding of what is a fact. Secondly, it provides information on non-elite groups of society. Literary sources are always the articulation of the upper sections of society. They were the ones that were educated. They were the ones that wrote down their thoughts. Archaeology, when you excavate a site, you excavate a village, you excavate a town, you're really looking at the life of the ordinary people. So the section of society that, in a sense, is ignored by literary sources is brought into the vision of the historian by the archaeologist. And the third important aspect, of course, is that it is the discipline of archaeology which is drawing on a lot of scientific methods of investigation. We have, therefore, things like, let me see if I can get this right, I always get it mixed up, paleo-osteopathology, which means the study of bones that come out of excavations dating back to 3000 BC, 2000 BC, 1000 AD, and so on. Extremely interesting. For example, again, in the context of what we were talking about yesterday, the destruction of the Harappan cities and the Aryan invasion, so-called, somebody came up with a theory that in Mohenjo-Daro you find skeletons strewn all over the floors. And immediately everybody said Mortimer Wheeler was right when he said the Aryans came in and invaded, and this is pure, straightforward evidence of invasion. Until a leading paleo-osteopathologist got working on the skeletons and discovered that the cause of death was not a sudden death, that there was no indication of any brutality, there was no indication of destruction by weapons. The cause of death was very, very severe anemia. And this was true of all the skeletons that came out of these floor levels at Mohenjo-Daro. So immediately the picture changes, and the historian then starts asking a totally different set of questions. A different set of questions that moves right away from theories of Aryan invasions and starts looking at the reality on the ground in terms of what happened to these people that they died of this very massive, intensive anemia. Similarly, studies of climate and vegetation are based, again, on what is called paleobotany, which is a combination of two sciences using the evidence from archaeology. Ecology becomes an extremely important factor in all of this. One talks about deforestation and salination and so on, which I will mention, discuss in a little more detail tomorrow. There is also then the introduction of the notion of demography. If we are going to talk about societies of the past and we're going to talk about political control and economic change, what are the numbers of people that we're considering? It is interesting that the average length of life of the Harappans was anywhere between 40 to 45 years. It is interesting that the great city of Mohenjo-daro, which we regard as a major urban center of that civilization, had a total population of about 45,000. Where's that, and where are the cities of today? So that it immediately brings the historian down to earth with a bang, and one realizes that one is not talking about even the Delhis and the Bombays and the Calcuttas of yesterday when one is talking about great cities. One's talking at a totally different dimension of a much smaller concentration of people in the context of a smaller general population. The only figures that we can compute really for population are the ones based on that superb account of Mughal administration, revenue administration, the famous Ayn-e-Akbari of Abul Fazl. And it has been argued that in the 16th century, therefore, the Mughal Empire had a total population of 110 million. And this is a generous estimate. So if one goes back in time, one suddenly realizes that perhaps for the Mauryas, one is talking of about 30 million people altogether. Which again gives you a very new dimension to the whole discussion of political authority, economic organization, and various other issues that we've been talking about. Other disciplines which also help us, linguistics, extremely important in telling us what is the structure of languages that people use, who are the people involved? As I was trying to tell you yesterday, that we no longer talk about pure Indo-Aryan. We already have to talk about a mixed language. And this is true of languages through Indian history. And other disciplines, such as anthropology, social anthropology, economic anthropology, the history of technology. The study of place names is extremely important, again, both in terms of linguistics as well as in terms of giving us a description of what the place originally was. Very often you have place names which relate to villages, those villages become towns, but the name continues, so that you know at a particular point that town was a village. Well, that's another story altogether. Yes, it could be Vihar, one isn't sure. The other area, let me touch on this very briefly and then stop, is the importance, I'm reminded because you asked me a question, but also the importance of the oral tradition. Mr. Bhaskaran has just given me a copy of his book, which I'm hoping to read in the next couple of days, on the use of things like the film as part of the oral tradition in the national movement. The use of the oral tradition has become a very important aspect of the study, at least, of modern history. And groups such as those that call themselves the subaltern historians, who believe in looking at history from below, the history of the people rather than the history of elite groups, have been doing a lot of work in looking at folk songs, folk poetry, interviewing people who have memories of events that have occurred and trying to reconstruct events. Not in terms of what is the correct reconstruction, because the historian, let me say as part of my concluding piece, the historian is really no longer concerned with the single correct reconstruction. The historian is concerned with explaining a set of circumstances, a set of evidences, a situation. And consequently, the historian is not a judge, as he was believed to be in the old days, sitting in judgment on the past, weighing the evidence and saying, yes, right, this is what happened. The historian is now saying that the evidence seems to suggest all of this. There may be new evidence that will come in and will either add to or subtract from what we know at the moment. But fundamentally what we are concerned with is understanding the past and not passing judgment on it. Understanding the past largely because there is a very close link between the past and the present. We are in fact very much products of the past and looking at a future, and consequently the understanding of the past becomes extremely necessary to us in terms of understanding of the present. And theories of explanation, therefore, cannot be ignored. History cannot be simply a narration of events without some attempt at correlating, at interrelating, at intertwining these events and trying to explain why these events took place, why they took a particular form, and in what way are those events part of our own antecedents. Just say that I'm very pleased that Professor Gopal has joined us here so that I can fend off all the questions on modern studies to him.
I was interested in one point which in fact you have not given up a lot of light. You said that the 300 types of...
I must confess, to be absolutely honest with you, that I really don't know the northeastern tribal groups in terms of history. I can say something about the tribal groups in central India, which I have studied. The main point that I would like to start with is that I think that the separation, the distinction between what is called caste society and tribal society is a distinction which is a very ancient one. It is a distinction in which traditionally members of the caste society looked upon tribal groups as the mlech. They're described as impure, outside the social pale, low. And very often, for example, hunters and gatherers among tribal groups were converted into untouchables and were kept outside caste society. Now, I would agree, for example, with historians like D.D. Kusandi, who has argued that at one level, the history of India, the social history of India can be seen in terms of the expansion of caste society, either confronting and destroying the tribals or incorporating the tribals into caste society at different levels. That is, your tribal chief becomes a kshatriya and your tribal priest is incorporated into the Brahmin caste and the rest of the tribesmen become vaishyas and shudras, mainly shudras, shudra cultivators. Or alternatively, converting the entire tribe into untouchables. There are three possibilities, and I think that this is certainly a theory that I would subscribe to, because in the period after the 5th century AD, we have particularly good inscriptional evidence where the movement of settlements into new areas is indicated by the giving of grants of land to either Brahmins or to officials in what is called wasteland, areas that have not been settled before, surrounded by tribal populations, where you get the gradual process of what M.N. Srinivas, the sociologist, has called Sanskritization. I don't know whether Professor Betai discussed this concept with you. Now, the historians of pre-modern India, use this concept quite substantially because we find that historically it makes a lot of sense, with one distinction, that we use it in a very broad way. We don't, first of all, try and write it with a capital S. We are not referring so much to Brahmanic culture as such, although there is a substantial amount of Brahmanic culture. We write it with a small s. And our concern is really much more with seeing how these groups are incorporated into what is called the Sanskritic tradition, or the great tradition, or the larger tradition. If you look at religious sects very often, from about the 8th, 9th century onwards, there are very interesting analyses of the incarnations of Vishnu, such as Narasimha, or one closer to us, Vitthal at Pandharpur. where it is quite clearly an amalgamation of Brahmanical religion, Puranic religion, and tribal religion, all coming together. Now, this process is very clearly visible in central India, in the whole of the peninsula, where there have been tribal societies, and inscriptions talk about these tribal groups right up until the 15th, 16th centuries. And then you get Persian chronicles that talk about the whole Mughal administration of areas that have tribal societies. So that this is a continuing feature, and of course, if one takes into account that the population of India was much smaller earlier on, the incorporation of tribal groups would be something that would be extremely important. Now, as far as the Northeast is concerned, there is a tendency to suggest that probably the tribal groups remained much more isolated for a longer historical period. That is, that because of the sparsity of the population in the region, let us say, east of Assam, or east of Kamarup, east of Guwahati, as it is now. Because of the sparseness of population, it was possible for tribal groups up in the hills particularly to carry on their way of life, undisturbed by the people on the plains. The confrontation traditionally was that between agriculture and hunting and gathering. So if there was enough space for agriculturalists to go in and settle down and cultivate, they didn't bother too much about the hill people. It is only when you moved into the forest and you began cutting down the forest in order to clear land for cultivation that the hunting and gathering people came in and objected, and you had confrontations, as was the case in central India and in the peninsula. Some of the tribal groups continued for a much longer time, which is why historically you don't really get a movement into the tribal areas until almost the 19th century. The late 18th century, the 19th century, except in small pockets. You have the Ahoms that come in, they merge with Brahmanical Puranic culture and they produce a kind of mixed cultural tradition. You have the Meiteis in Manipur, which again are a mixture of Brahmanical Puranic tribal culture and so on. But for example, Manipur is a very interesting case where you have the whole Vaishnavite tradition of agriculturalists in the valley areas. And up in the hills, you've got the Nagas, who are totally different and are using a different cultural idiom altogether. So I think that unlike the central Indian tribal people, who have myths of long migrations, and who argue that they were once settled in the Ganges Plain and then were pushed into the forests of the Vindhyas, the northeastern tribal people don't have such myths of origin. They seem to have been indigenous to these areas and seem to have lived there right from the start. Consequently, I think it's much more a case of lowland and upland, where the tribal populations managed to survive for a longer period in the upper reaches of the elevated areas and were not disturbed to that extent by people in the plains. The Andamans and the Bengalis, I'm sorry. Who is this historian who says it? He says that the Bengalis came from the Andamans.
He says that we have to see the real Bengalis
and go to Andaman. Now, yes, that I can understand in terms of the argument that is put forward. If you accept this notion of the constant interaction between caste society and tribal society, you then assume that in each area, not just the Bengalis, but everywhere in India, if you are really wanting to trace yourself back to your indigenous root, then you go to the nearest tribal population. Because that's obviously the stock from which you came and you were converted into a caste and you took to other technologies and you developed in a different way. So that in fact, the argument would be that if you're looking for the roots of Indian society, you must go to the tribal populations. That would be the way in which that kind of statement could be understood. Yes, but it's still not the same massive migration that is postulated by the tribal myths of central India, who really do talk about a huge distance. The northeastern tribes also, for example, don't have mythologies that take them that far, but there is a suggestion that there are Southeast Asian links, which is perfectly feasible. There could well be migrations coming up that way through Thailand, through the upper Burma valleys into these areas. But the only problem is that this is not an area that has been worked on. I mean, the only way in which you can confirm these migrations is if you get archaeological evidence for it, because these are not people with written records. So until the archaeology of this area is uncovered, it will be very difficult to actually suggest that they did migrate.
When the indication is bad or the northeast, I think more interesting.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I think it's an area that is very neglected.
I have two questions. You mentioned that.
Let me start with your second question, which is easier to answer, and that is that we do now have accounts. For example, the Mauryan Empire extends through virtually the whole of the subcontinent with a part of Afghanistan right down to just south of Mysore. The Mauryan inscriptions, the Ashokan inscriptions, speak of my southern neighbors, the Cholas, the Cheras, and the Pandyas. And when the inscriptions were first deciphered, one didn't know too much about the Cholas and the Cheras and the Pandyas. Since then, there has been evidence from the Tamil Sangam literature, there has been evidence from archaeology, very massive evidence from archaeology, the excavation of a number of sites in the area, a lot of evidence also from classical accounts, Greek accounts that speak of seafarers that go around to that region. And for the slightly post-Mauryan period, the 2nd century BC, the discovery of large numbers of inscriptions where the Brahmi script has been used for the writing of Tamil, what is called Tamil Brahmi. So that we do know what was going on. We have a very clear idea of what was happening in this part of the country whilst the Mauryas were ruling just to the north, as it were. Similarly for the other large spread empires. Now this is precisely the point that I was making about one of the important positive features of regional history, that by looking at the history of the local region through a period of time, you're able to constantly correlate what you're finding in this region with the broader national history. And so you can say that whilst the Guptas were ruling up north of the Narmada or in the northern Deccan and the Ganges Valley, the following things were happening in the south, the following things were happening in the east, and so on. It is possible to say that now.
No.
In fact, one of the most interesting things is that the Mauryas, whose inscriptions are found in the whole of the Mysore region, all of the different categories of Ashok's inscriptions are found there. They obviously were very active in the Kolar gold fields, because there is evidence of the working of those gold fields going back to that period. But the archaeological sites around there reflect not one item that can be clearly defined as Mauryan, other than the inscriptions. So that raises a very interesting question for the historian, that what was the Mauryan presence in that area? Was it just a distant imperial government presence, where there were local people who were looking after the administration, who were mining the gold fields, who were carrying on the trade and so on? And sort of in name, there was some kind of political control of the Mauryas. But if one didn't have the Mauryan inscriptions there, one would not be able to say that this region was under Mauryan control. So that very often these regional differences go on for a much longer period and force historians to reconsider the whole question of, as you rightly put it, the style of life. What is happening? Is it really the same all over the subcontinent, or does it vary from region to region, even in periods of imperial control? Oh, yes, the first question. Yes, the point that I was trying to make is really that it's something which I will be talking about on Thursday morning, so I don't want to say too much about it now. The point that I was trying to make was that you really have a series of religious groups, cults, sects that function from during this period. The only clearly defined, well-organized religions with an order, a church, missionaries, locations that are well-defined are the Buddhists and the Jains, what are generally called the shamanic religions, because they are in fact what is called institutionalized. They have institutions that back them up. Now, it's only in the Gupta period that you begin to get temples built to Hindu deities. Before that, there is no evidence of temples. So we don't really know what the location of these different religious cults might have been. There is no archaeological evidence of sites where Vedic sacrifices have been conducted until about the 2nd century AD. So we know from the literature that the sacrifices were conducted, but we don't have the archaeological evidence, as we have in the case of the Buddhists and the Jains. So that the presence of these monuments, institutions, structures, and so on, makes one understand that in fact the identity with religion was much more diffused to local cults and sects rather than an overarching monolithic religion. And that is what I meant by saying that it is difficult to define this whole period of 4,000 years as a Hindu period.
Yeah. Just put up this is the migration of people in the first century, either accompanied by a dynasty or expanding of empire. I've always been in a certain wonder, for example,
of migration in the opposite direction. Unfortunately, again, the emphasis on the migration from the north to the south is partly because the whole emphasis of Indian history was that it was North Indian history that was determining what was happening everywhere. What I find very interesting is that there is all this fuss made about Samudragupta as the Napoleon of India, because he took his armies down the Ganges Valley, down the east coast, almost as far south as Kanchi, according to some people, almost as far south as Kanchipuram. And so, you know, he's described as a Napoleon. One of the Chola kings takes his armies up the east coast and into the Ganges Valley and claims that he has brought back Ganges water for his family to bathe in.
Rajendra.
Nobody refers to that. Now this is, you know, it's the mirror image of Samudragupta. Yet every history book will tell you about Samudragupta being the Napoleon of India, but no history book will talk about any of the Chola kings being a Napoleon of India. The Tamil history took ahead. Well, precisely, that's my point about regional history now. Yeah.
The Rajendra Chola's visit to the Ganges is a recorded one.
Yes.
But you don't see that, should we say, widespread in the Indian history. It's not mentioned in, Kavali books, or it is not considered as part of
the... Yeah, because there has been a very strong bias towards writing Indian history from a North Indian point of view. You know, that bias has been there for so long that it's going to take some time before one begins to develop a concept of an all-India history. And that is...
In another way, Professor, the Vijayanagara Empire, which is much more recent, is mentioned in one paragraph in most books, one or two, never more than that. Whereas it influenced the southern part of India in a very, very deep way, culturally and all that.
Yeah.
The Chola expansion to the forest is also not mentioned.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Professor, you told for the Aurangzeb that he destroyed this Mathura temple because it was built by the king. Now, how can you attribute that to this Aurangzeb's destruction account will be much more than whatever he gives the benefit? And because the king destroyed him, there were so many people who are opposing him. Do you mean that whoever opposed him, he destroyed everything? You take the case of Bijapur Sultan. He destroyed the Bijapur Sultan's whole city.
No, well, I wasn't saying.
The jizya tax.
At one point, there is the difference of religion. One doesn't deny that. In the same way as Mahmud of Ghazni, for example, when he comes, he claims to be an idol breaker because it is required of him to be an idol breaker in his religion. His main purpose is to get the wealth of the temple. One of the interesting things is that you have all these chronicles that talk about Mahmud of Ghazni in Turkish, talk about him going and destroying the temple at Somnath. We have a very famous Kashmiri scholar called Bilharna, who visits Somnath two generations after Mahmud's destruction of the temple, and makes no mention of this. He talks about the Gujaratis, he talks about Somnath, he talks about his visit there, he makes no mention whatever of Mahmud having come and destroyed the temple. Yes, he has. He says so quite clearly that he's visited the temple. He says he's gone and prayed at the temple as well. No, the point that I was trying to make was not that the attempt is not to whitewash Aurangzeb and say that he only destroyed didn't destroy mosques and he only destroyed temples. The thing is that clearly he wouldn't destroy a mosque. He is a Muslim. One isn't denying that. But what I am trying to suggest is that if somebody destroys a religious monument, the reason is not only religious. There can be other reasons for his doing it. And what is curious is that he destroys some temples, but he helps in the building of others.
That also may not be religious and his generosity, but to please a particular section of people or to be on his side.
Precisely. That's exactly what I said.
All right. And we have the Aurangzeb's atrocities are concerned. But all is the destruction and the society picture and other things is a very different in this Das Buddha by Ramdasa. What was the picture at that time? What was the atrocities committed? And what was the life of the people?
Yes.
Right,
but by the same token, you must ask yourself, with every book that you read, including the books that we write these days, what is the bias of the man who's writing that book? And until you're familiar with the bias of the person, the author, do not take the book for granted. That's all I can say. I mean, this is something that, you know, long years of looking at books has taught me. That every author writes a book with a particular point of view. So you must, first of all, be aware of that point of view. You must understand whether, in fact, you have to discount a certain percentage of what he says because of that point of view, and then look at what is being said. This is, again, where interpretation comes in, very important. Very few. I can't think of any.
The Japan version that you have presented of Aurangzeb is based mostly on Salman's of Aurangzeb. Could this also, how do you consider that this is very authentic? Could this also have been biased?
The Farmans are documents in the hands of Brahmin families and temple authorities, on the basis of which, for example, where he grants land to a Brahmin, from that period until the 18th, 19th centuries, these were the legal documents on the basis of which the Brahmins would say, this is our land. And that land goes from my son to my grandson and so on. So these are legal documents. They're absolutely authentic. Which is why one is not talking about travelers' accounts or, you know, other sources. One is talking about a straightforward legal document which is in the hands of a temple or is in the hands of a family.
Yeah, another question I want to ask is, we fear of outsiders coming, from people from China and other people going around India and making reports of all these things. How is it that no Indians thought of it?
That's a question which I'm trying to answer. Somebody asked me to give a lecture on the subject of Indians and their attitudes to Europe in the pre-modern period. And I readily agreed. And then I sat back and I said, where do I find the evidence for it? There isn't a single Indian text. And this bothers me because you had Indian traders going all over the world, for example. You had them in Central Asia, in China, you had them in Africa, in the Mediterranean, you have them in Southeast Asia. There isn't a single description of any place that an Indian went to, lived in, visited, saw, not a single description.
But isn't that because the class which was doing the trading was not meant to be literate?
Oh, they were literate. You have to be. Traders have to be literate. No, but the thing is that after all, the chaps who are writing descriptions of India are very often traders too, who are coming from outside. They had a minimum of literacy. You would think that at least they would come back and say to somebody, you know, this is what I saw, why don't you write it down, or something like that. But there is absolutely no evidence.
What about Jatakatis?
Those are invented for local consumption. They're not, I mean, there are one or two tales that talk about ships going out to the seas and so on, but that's all. Otherwise, it's all description of local life. And so I just feel that there is something very intrinsic in this, that there was a complete lack of wanting to describe what one had seen and heard in a literary form. But I don't know the answer to that question. Well, we do make some attempts now.
Newspaper
articles. In the sense, we know that so much information has been collected, so much research is being done and all that. Has it been ever thought or planned that such information would be changed from time to time? It is made available for the general people when it's possible. So I deliver to you, we come to all the new things. But is there any attempt to update these things and do it for the benefit of
the people? The attempt will come once the general public says that it wants to know. I think one of the major differences, for example, between the so-called Western society and our society is that there you do have people, whether it is, you have in a sense what one might call research and intellectual entrepreneurs. That is, they take the research that is being done at the level of scholarship and they put it into a popular form and they put it out into books and television and the media and so on and so forth. Because people are interested, people want to know. But here that doesn't happen. And most researchers have to make up their minds as to whether they're going to pursue research and try and make new discoveries or whether they're going to spend their time popularizing.
No,
they can't do both.
History as
we have tried. We sometimes meet with peculiar situations. For example, some of us wrote textbooks for the NCERT, for middle school and high school, over which some of us spent a lot of time. I spent 3 years on 2 textbooks that I wrote, and I tried them out in school first and with children, and I tried my best to put in all the new kind of research that was being done. And then I had to spend 2 years during the period of the Janata government fighting to keep those textbooks in because it was argued that I was being anti-Indian because I was not saying the conventional things in those textbooks.
But even present textbooks, which the typical average school uses, is quite anti-Indian.
That's not our business, in a sense, you see, because we have written the textbooks. It is up to the local textbook board to decide which textbooks they are going to prescribe. Now, that's a totally different ball game because that involves a whole lot of illiterate textbook writers who write textbooks in order to make money. It involves a whole lot of pavement publishers who publish because they want to make money. It involves corruption at the level of members of the board who will prescribe these books because they get a commission. Now, that is something that we as researchers can't control. That's a civic problem.
But we as a society sort of owe it to the next generation.
Sure. So you as a society must agitate and see that that something is done about it.
Hence this program.
After Mr. Banerjee. I didn't see the serial, I'm afraid. I missed it. I missed it. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't know we'd be coming for
the various reasons. First of all, when the history of India first began to be written, there was a premium on regarding Brahmanical sources as authentic. And because Buddhist and Jain sources were regarded as part of the heterodoxy, opposed to Brahmanical orthodoxy, they were not taken as seriously as they should have been. They tended to be ignored. And it was not till the late 19th century that, for example, Buddhist and Jain sources began to be taken more seriously. And even now, there really hasn't been enough work done on the Jain tradition and the Jain sources, of which there is a vast amount of material that could be tapped, very usefully, in fact. In this specific situation, you must remember, of course, also that Buddhism and Jainism were the predominant religions in both Tamil Nadu and Karnataka until about the 5th, 6th centuries AD. Certainly by the 7th century, you begin to develop a hostility to both of them. Buddhism is virtually thrown out, and Jainism continues to flourish, but is very heavily opposed, particularly by Shaivism. There are inscriptions, many inscriptions from Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh, which talk about the particular hostility of the Veera Shaiva against the Jains, where the monks are killed, monasteries are destroyed, temples are destroyed, the images are pulled out, and Shaivite images are put in the place of Jain images, and so on. So there was obviously a lot of hostility and antagonism. Now, because there has been this obsessive generalization that Indian civilization was a non-violent civilization and very tolerant, people tend not to talk about these things. But in fact, there is a lot of evidence for this kind of hostility, and that would be one reason why. Certainly after the 12th century, there is a very rapid decline of Jainism in these areas. There are very few monasteries that manage to maintain themselves, Jain monasteries in Karnataka.
Is it also true of the Gnostic era where Buddhism...
Yes, it's certainly, it's true of Kashmir where, I mean, Kalhan again in his Rajatarangani talks about the destruction of Buddhist monasteries and the killing of Buddhist monks by Shaivites.
Like, see,
what
do you believe that the Jains and Buddhists, and actually in Andhra, for example, in the proper direction to the 1st century BC to 3rd or 4th century AD, there the kings were Buddhist, they were following the Buddhist religion, and the kings were predominantly Hindu. And in fact, it was not considered a separate thing. And in fact, if you have visited, I think perhaps you would have known that the Nagarjuna Sagar, where that museum is also erected, and all, most of those donations, etc., were given by the kings.
My reaction to that is that this is a very common phenomenon during this period from the 2nd century BC to the 3rd century AD, where a lot of the women of royal families are major patrons and donors. The men are not Hindus in that sense. The kings frequently perform Vedic sacrificial rituals. They perform the Mahayagyas. The Mahayagyas by this time are also ceremonies of legitimation. That is that when you set yourself up as king, you not only say, I am the head of the Sangha, if there is a Buddhist community, you also perform a Rajasuya or an Abhishekha or an Ashwamedha or whatever it may be. And as you know from Nagarjuna Karna, the remains, there are supposed to be ritual tanks where these ceremonies were performed. Now, the question is really that were these ceremonies performed entirely as expressions of religious belief, or are they not also political statements of legitimation, which is very often the case with these? Secondly, I would question your statement that the people were not Buddhists, because if you look at the monuments and the inscriptions again, the major donations that come in terms of the number of donations are from the ordinary people. They are all ordinary small-scale landowners, artisans, traders, and so on. They are the ordinary people, and they are substantially Buddhist.
Is there some weight to what Professor Jayesh Sarkar says, that the Buddhists were also inviting in invaders from outside, and that might have been good? I'm talking about the younger Jayesh Sarkar, not Jayesh Sarkar.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is talking about also the community, but he is also talking of that the Buddhist establishment had invited, say, the invasion in 711. No, 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 there's no evidence for that. No, there's no question of the Buddhist establishment inviting in. You mean in Sindh, where R.C. Majumdar refers to the Buddhists as the fifth columnists?
No, they're not doing any inviting. All that is happening is that when the Arab armies are marching in, the Buddhists are saying, we're in our monasteries, please leave us alone. They're not fighting back. They're not fighting back. And this, according to Majumdar, was an act of betrayal, that the monks should have taken to arms and fought. But there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that they were inviting people in. In fact, the evidence later on is much more strongly of people like Rana Kumbha and so on inviting Baba in order to get rid of the Lodhis and whatnot. You know, that's evidence is very strong. But the Buddhists certainly can't be faulted as being people inviting the foreigners in. No. Yeah. No, no, there's just absolutely no evidence to support that.
Professor, by mentioning about the concept of regional district, you also mentioned about the what you call the viability of the region. Now, there are regions like, for example, Gujarat or Rajasthan, which has a very rich tradition of history. Whereas, say, for example, the state of Madhya Pradesh, the southern state of Madhya Pradesh. Even there are pockets which were, for example, the Holkars or the Sindhias or even the other small ruling councils.
I'm sorry, there's a misunderstanding. I was not arguing that these areas do not have a viable history. They do, very much so. What I was arguing was that these areas as regional groups do not have a viable history. That is, that the history of Madhya Pradesh, as a self-contained region with an independent history, goes back only a few decades. I'm making that difference. That really, what I'm really trying to suggest is that each of the state boundaries as they have come about are historically evolved. But that doesn't mean that you start off in the year 2000 BC by saying, this is the boundary of the state of Gujarat and we're writing the history of Gujarat. You're creating the same kind of problems that Mortimer Wheeler created when he talked about 5,000 years of Pakistan. In his famous book where he took the history of Pakistan back to Mohenjo-daro, which is historically absolute nonsense because there was no Pakistan then. So you can't talk about 5,000 years of Pakistan, you can't talk about 5,000 years of Gujarat or 5,000 years of Madhya Pradesh or even 5,000 years of Tamil Nadu or whatever. That's what I meant about confusing the concept of a region, which is a perfectly viable geographical concept, and that region may have its historical tradition. But that cannot be confused with the boundaries of the present-day states, and the argument then be made that these states have a history that goes back.
As you hinted already, that history by and large is subjective. I was wondering whether there is any connection of history with anthropology and sociology. If it is so, how it is that European history we understand in terms of evolution, they have been progressing from a barbaric society to one of modern society. Whereas in India, we are supposed to have had a very highly developed society with a very rich culture, tradition, one of the finest literature, philosophy, mathematics and science and everything else, then how it is that...
I think if you were to put that question to a 25-year-old, they would say there's no question of degeneration. We're looking forward to a great future. No, I think what is really happening is not that we are degenerating and decaying, but we are going through a very critical situation of change. And this is the kind of thing that I'm sure must have happened repeatedly in the past, where you do find that a certain set of values and so on are being questioned. There seems to be, we are all complaining of this, that these people of my generation are complaining about a decline of values, as you say quite rightly. But I don't think the end result is going to be one of complete decay. I think that obviously we're moving in another direction in which hopefully in a generation or two there will be values which will come up again and which will determine society. Because after all, a society without any commitment to values and ethics cannot survive. And I don't see the picture as being so pessimistic that we are actually heading towards annihilation. No, sure, there's a law and order problem, but it's a question of putting it right.
But one would like to remind Mr. Dwivedi that Europe went through two world wars where they killed some 20 million people And because they've had some very bad days, which you probably wouldn't call bad because you were not there. But if you had seen the destruction in 1945, you would have known what difficult days they went through.
My compliment to that, and that is of course that what you said about the way of looking at European history is what historians call the Whig interpretation of history, which is that history is a matter of, especially as far as Europe is concerned, is a matter of progress going, and as Bailey said, going on and up and up. But nowadays, British and European historians don't take that view, and they take the view that, as Dr. Ramana pointed out, that the history of Europe is something that has its ups and downs, and Ramana said the 20th century is certainly not anything of which European historians are proud of.
Can I ask one question and one comment, madam? This question, I've been brought up believing that Aurangzeb was a very bad man, as you can understand from the period I belong to, we all belong to. But how is it that now there is a strong move to reinstate those people whom we thought were very communal, anti-Hindu rulers? And there are one or two cases which are rather curious, like take Vijayanagar, Hampi. The whole city, enormous great city, was destroyed completely except for the Virupaksha temple. Mm. And now again, there are many TV serials coming up, or supposed to be coming up, on Tipu Sultan, and that he didn't destroy the Ranganatha temple and the Sringeri ashram and all that. Now that's of course very recent time, one could explain the city. Mm. Now do these temples survive because of purely political issues, or superstitious issues, or they were just waiting for their time to destroy it when they became powerful enough? That's the comment I'll make.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that the attempt is to try and whitewash the characters that were regarded as bad characters in the past, because the whole thrust of what I've been trying to suggest this afternoon is really that we are looking at a totality of historical factors. That whereas previously there would be a particular individual who would be picked out for his evil deeds and so on, now we're trying to put that individual into a context and see why he was behaving in a particular way. Now, the argument is by no means that Aurangzeb was a saint or that he was pro-Hindu or that he was not anti-Hindu. The argument is certainly that he was anti-Hindu, but the reasons for his hostility are reasons that have to do as much with political expediency as they have to do with religious bigotry. In other words, one's trying to get a bigger picture of the man, in the same way as analyses of Akbar today do not speak of him as a lily white man who was running around trying to create secular society and that kind of thing. There are many people who are critical of what he was doing in terms of what it meant for Mughal polity at that time, in terms of what it meant for the support or the hostility that he was getting from people. So that, in other words, what I was really trying to suggest was that in all these cases, and let me just preface these remarks with another remark, and that is that when one talks about the destruction of temples, let us not forget that temples, mosques, gurdwaras, what have you, major religious monuments, particularly monuments in capital cities and in important religious centers, are not only religious monuments, they are also political statements. Because there's a great deal that goes on in these institutions behind the monuments. A temple has a management committee, it has a whole committee of priests, it has people that come in and worship, it has sermonizing, it has congregations and so on. There's a whole social activity, there's a whole political activity that is going on in the temple, in the mosque, in the gurdwara and so on. Which the historian has to be cognizant of. These monuments cannot be treated purely as isolated, simple religious monuments. They're very, very complicated statements. And therefore, the destruction of these temples are as much political statements as they are religious statements. And Consequently, I would then go on to say that the people who are doing the destroying then have to be seen in the broader context of certainly being hostile to that religion because they are destroying a statement, a religious statement, but also that the destruction has a political statement that is being made. That's really the point that I was trying to make. Krishna Janambhumi temple at Mathura is built on the site of a Buddhist monastery. That the only evidence that comes from this entire area where this temple was built is Buddhist. And there is clear evidence of the destruction of this monastery before the building of the temple. You know, the whole question is that if one is going to look at religious monuments in terms of where they are built, one can just go on going back and back in time. The Buddhist stupa at Amaravati is built on the remains and destruction of a megalithic sacred site, which is an animistic site. What one must try and understand is that when religious monuments are put up, they choose sites. There is a choice of site, a very definite choice of site. The site is either that it was already a sacred site for an earlier religion, and therefore the site is considered sacred, and you go on building on it. That's one way in which you might explain how it is that many Hindu temples are built on Buddhist sites. If you choose to use that explanation. The other explanation is that when you are fighting against another religion in terms of spreading your message and trying to push out the other religion, you do build your religious monument on that site. You do convert that site to your purposes. And let us also understand that the relationship between a number of Hindu sects and Buddhist and Jain sects was not a happy relationship. You know, this is a myth of, again, of Orientalism and nationalism, that they all went on together.
No, there is no conviction on that. I mean, there is no impression that there was absolutely unity of interest because they were...
So there are examples where Hindu temples have been built on the sacred site of other religious groups, very deliberately making the statement that we are now the superior religious sect.
Any historian considered this as a passage where they have written something?
Not an entire monograph, but there are articles that have been written on this.
In our temple there is a monograph.
Mm-hmm.
How it was built on a Buddhist site by Dr. Suresh.
I see. I don't know that. But again, that is one temple. But no one has taken this as... It would be a very interesting thing to do, to take all these monuments. Also, this whole business of the number of mosques that have been built on the site of Hindu temples. Very often, the propaganda of numbers is much greater than what was actually the case. But it would be very, very interesting to take up all these religious monuments and see which sites they've been built on and why.
Can I make mine?
Your comment.
This is just, I don't know whether you have come across it. I was visiting Nalanda, and they said they had made the recent excavation. And since I was the guest of the government, they were very nice to me and said, we'll show you some new statues we have just discovered. And one of them was surprising. They said they had kept it inside because it may create trouble. And that was Bodhisattvas sparing Shiva, Parvati and Ganesha.
Mm.
And this we thought was very strange because it was the 14th century, long after Buddhism had become a unique religion. So I just thought that...
Yes. No, this the hostility between Shaivism and the Shramanic sects is a known hostility to historians all over the country. It comes up in Bengal, for example, and Bihar. It's frequent. They're accusing each other all the time. The Shaivite sects are saying, you started it, and the Shramanic sects are saying, no, you started it. But the hostility is certainly there, and unfortunately has been glossed over because people have been embarrassed about writing about intolerance.
Between modern texts also. and Dr. Ambedkar converted his father to Buddhism.
Yes, that was to try and get around the question of caste.
You know, we are discussing in, about history about a time where the world was much bigger than what it is today. And obviously information was not easily available.
Well, in answer to that, may I say first of all that it is not very clear what the facts are. What is a fact? I mean, you state certain things like Hitler's actions, political events, etc. But these, if I may say so, are rather on the surface. The real important things, as Tato was saying earlier, the real important things are the more basic, the social and economic trends, the changes over a period of time, and even below that, as she talked about environment, geography, what Brodel has taught us, you see, that history is really at three levels. The basic level, the fundamental level, which only changes, if it changes at all over the centuries, is the geographic and the climatic and the physical features. He has, for example, a long passage about how the melting of the snows of the Alps has affected the living and the history of the people living on the plains, no matter who the ruler was or what the dynasty was, whether his father was living by a prophet. Above that is the second level, where things change, but change slowly and over a period of time. These are the social and the economic factors. And it's on the surface, the ripples. These are the facts of which, if I understand you, you are talking about. And these facts, while they may seem very important to us at that time, are not really of great consequence in the history of change over time. It's not anything that really makes a great difference to human history. And therefore, you see, when one is talking of facts, the facts which are known, dated, and beyond question are, if I may say so, rather superficial. So if you merely list these facts, which are known facts, and leave it at that, then I don't think you will get very far in what Tathagata really said is the important thing about history, and that is the understanding of the interpretation rather than the pure record of the narrative. The record of the narrative is useful as evidence of data, but it doesn't really take you very far if you rely on just those alone.
No, I would just add one thing, and that is that please don't get the impression that when I'm talking about historical interpretation, I'm meaning that history is so subjective that any historian gets up and says, this is how one reads it. You see, the argument in interpretation, there is an argument based on evidence, there is an argument based on logic. And when I say that it is an explanation that we're looking for, that is extremely important. The reader will say, what is your evidence? And what is the logic of your argument? What is the kind of methodology that you're using? This is all extremely important.